Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
And it is John Gibbons for the Anfield Wrap, and we have another show on the biggest news story of the week, which is obviously the European Super League. Now, when we put this together, it was still a live thing. Remember that? When everyone was in, now no one's in. Everyone sort of withdrew. But we still want to get the opinions of the other five clubs who joined Liverpool in this breakaway league. Well, obviously supporters of those five clubs. So to help us with that, I've got Emily Brobin, who supports Manchester City, Jim Johnson from an Arsenal point of view. I've got Paul Dehaney, who's going to talk to us about Tottenham. Chris Barber for Chelsea and Andy Shaw for Manchester United. So first of all, everyone, thanks very much and welcome.
Hi, John.
How are you doing?
Afternoon.
I'm just going to go around the virtual room first of all and ask you just your opinions on the last few days, really, and where it leaves your sort of, you know, relationship with the club and the owners, really. So I'll start with you, Ant, if you don't mind. You know, how have you sort of found it all and what have you made of United's response?
Where to start, really? I think the relationship between the supporters and the owners has never been good. But I do think that they've sort of like revealed a hand as to what their end game is with regards to Manchester United. And, it, you know, that's far, you know, perhaps we're naive in thinking that was never the case, but it's certainly an uglier world than we've been living in for the last 16 years. I think the final, you know, to get a glimpse of that sort of franchise world, you know, American sort of type sport is, you know, it was seriously ugly. And I don't really see how that is ever going to recover now in terms of the club and its fans, because I mean, from my point of view, I've seen a couple of things this morning where people are saying the supporters have won. I think it's far from won. I think that in terms of the future, I think there's going to be a lot of attempts for a watered down or slower progression towards this type of model. And, you know, for me, that's really alarming because it's not a world in which I think English football fits in. I think in terms of United and its support, they've got to sort of shrink while the iron's hot a bit, because it's the first time ever that everybody's been unanimous about something, and I think that's come about because they've moved so quickly. In terms of the next 5 years, I think they're going to slowly and try to do this more subtly, and it's something now where they've revealed the hand and supporters need to do something about it, because I do think that's where we're heading. You know, even in the current Champions League and under UEFA, we've got reforms there that are seriously alarming, and they do just look like a watered down version. So I don't see where we go from here other than we need owners out of our football clubs.
It's really interesting. Well, I mean, quite a few things you said there was really interesting, but certainly in terms of using this feeling of the galvanised support to do further change, because as you say, Ant, you know, this wasn't, you know, the only bad thing going on in football, you know, not even this week, to be honest with you, when you look at sort of, as you say, the Champions League changes. And is there a feeling, obviously you're involved in the United We Stand fanzine, which is, you know, well sort of, you know, thought of within the fan base, and obviously, you know, sort of well established within the fan base as well. Is the feeling that, well, actually, you know, now everyone is, you know, having this feeling of, you know, togetherness and what, looking at what we can achieve, the idea is, well, let's sort of kick on from here.
Yeah, and there's two ways of going about it, you know, and I understand that the Supporters Trust has decided to, you know, start lobbying more politically. And, you know, maybe that would have success. I can't really say I hold out much hope down that avenue. But also, you know, supporters need to make themselves clear that, you know, they're not going to tolerate that. And we're not going to actually be in a world in 5 years where we're watching United in a franchise league, because, you know, as all I can see there is that it's going to be a world where success and profits aren't impacted by league position. And therefore, you know, they can finish fifth. There's just no clamour to finish at the top of the league. And that's what English football is all about.
Exactly. Okay, we'll go across Manchester then and to Emily. Have you been a bit surprised, Emily, that the City sort of went for this? Because it does feel that you guys have obviously spent the last, you know, 4 to 5 years fighting on the pitch and in courtrooms with the established elite, and then now to sort of, you know, to get into bed with everyone, if you like, and do that. Did that become as a bit of a shock to City fans?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why we were also furious, because why go through all the bother and the hassle and the pain, and so why just take UEFA on like that and then just go and hop into bed like this? So I think we were all really surprised as well, because I mean, we all take pelters constantly, you know, as fans, for, you know, the oil club slogans and all that, and it isn't nice, but what can you do? But we were really surprised, because the owners do put a lot into the local community, and they've worked really, really hard doing that, investing heavily in the local community. So for them to be like that and then to do that, we were all just absolutely staggered by it, staggered. And I don't know where we go, because City fans, 95% of what I've seen on socials today, all is forgiven, because Sheikh Mansour has done so much for the local community and for the club. And people are saying, well, it's his first mistake and nobody's perfect. So from what I see, a lot of people are kind of just forgiving, but I do think a few just won't forget. And I think in particular, obviously, the other clubs involved in this, you know, like the 14 Premier League clubs, we're just going to take even more pelters from now on. And it's just so uncomfortable all around. But yeah, I just didn't expect it from City. Even with all the money involved and, you know, the slogans that come with the club these days and the reputation we've got, I did think that we were better than that.
One positive, I guess, from a City point of view is that I thought Pep Guardiola probably spoke the best of all the managers. He probably, you know, was in a slightly better position than the ones who were sort of, you know, had a microphone straight after the game. But I thought, you know, he went probably above and beyond what he needed to, and probably what you could have expected to of essentially a club employee.
Yeah, he came out all guns blazing, really. And there was a rumour going around that he was being silenced before the presser. And I thought, nah, Pep being silenced, are you for real? When has he ever been silenced? When can you silence Pep? But I was just so glad to see the honesty and the passion from him, because he set his stall out in the press conference. He made it abundantly clear. And he said, like, no matter what happens, we'll get through it together. And he was referring to the staff at the club as well. And he was just referring to things that he knew how much of an effect it had throughout the club on like a lower level with the staff, and obviously with the fans as well, the players. So I was so pleased to see Pep come out and do that and defend us like that, and yeah, just wear his heart on his sleeve, really. But it would have been quite clear, wouldn't it, I think, between Pep and Klopp, that they wouldn't have stuck around if it would have gone ahead.
Yeah, no, it would have been interesting to see what would have happened as it did. I'll go to Jim next, and Arsenal. Arsenal seem to have had a lot of pelters for the fact that, you know, your league position and things like that. And a lot of people say, well, you know, including, you know, Arsenal legends and former players and, you know, guys like Ian Wright say, well, why do we think we have a divine right to sort of be in this competition when we're struggling at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I've already said on you know, another media outlet this week, John, that, you know, Arsenal's European record is quite lamentable in terms of its stature. But we are the eighth richest club in the world, and that's what this was all about, wasn't it? And I mean, funnily enough, you know, in preparation for this piece and the piece I did on Bauer Media earlier on the week, I was asked off air, you know, and I committed to it on air and said that I never thought it would happen.
Right.
So my question to myself was then, well, do I know more than Stan Kroenke? And if I'm actually going on the media, you know, on a media outlet and saying this isn't going to happen, well, of course I don't know more than those people, right? The issue here is very much about the phony war that is brewing between the Big 12 and UEFA, right? And obviously the media story has been the lack of fan consultation. Well, if you're building up to have a war and you're going to do your first broadside shots across the bow, the last thing you're going to do is negotiate with the public on this, So the hastily agreed, you know, sort of withdrawals and the responses therein from the clubs and my club in, you know, in the thick of this, I kind of see through a little bit, because I sort of think that you know, this is just the start, right? And whatever is brewing is still going to continue brewing down the line. I mean, obviously a lot of what was happening was designed to steal the wind, I think, out of the sails of the revamped Champions League program, which clearly is not in the interests of the big six, as it were, you know, in terms of like their value to the revenue of kind of global appeal of football as an international brand. So from that point of view, nothing has kind of surprised me in terms of the way the Kroenke family do business. Because if you look at their record at managing sports franchises, they'll quite happily move a well-loved American sports franchise halfway across the United States to suit their own ends. It was interesting what Emily said about Pep. Because I mean, there's been lots of quotes attributed to Arsene Wenger around, you know, Arsenal's sort of response. I mean, and one of the big ones was, you know, Wenger saying in his farewell address at the Emirates, you know, that we should look after Arsenal values moving forward. And I think, you know, from an Arsenal fan who's nearly 50, and has lived through the good and the bad. The one thing that you'll hear a lot about in football is the Arsenal way and the Arsenal way of doing things. And this is very much so far away from what is considered to be the Arsenal way. And remember, Arsenal, you know, historically were known as the Bank of England club. Now, that wasn't because they were rolling in the books. It was because lots of the shareholders and the people at the top table of the Arsenal boardroom were all merchant bankers. That's where they come from. Now, when Stan Kroenke moved in, just to refresh people's memories, when Stan Kroenke bought his shares, this was after David Dean had tried to bring Stan Kroenke in, but Peter Hill Wood had actually said, this was the late Arsenal chair who had inherited that position from his father, Dennis Hill Wood, who inherited that position from Sir Henry Norris, who basically got Arsenal into the first division back in 1919. So this is what the legacy of the Arsenal, you know, tradition meant. And, you know, Peter Hill Wood said about Stan Kroenke, "We don't want his sort." That was his exact quote, right? Now, David Dean was then marched out of his office by all accounts, because what he tried to do as a result of that Stan Kroenke intervention, he then bought up shares with Alisher Osmanov. And Arsenal has never been the same. Now, what I think is particularly interesting is what's come out of the government's response today. They were blowing their trumpet on Monday, you know, Oliver Dowden saying, "We are the people's government. We're going to look at root and branch, review into the way that the game is run." But already today, the government are now saying, "Well, we don't want a German model. We think that's really draconian." And it's like, people run with the hares and run with the hounds, you know? And I just think, you know, regardless of Arsenal's response, I actually thought, you know, the press release was one of the better ones of the six, you know, that we put together as our club. But this is a phony war. These are the early shots across the broadside for me.
Really interesting stuff. Thanks so much for that, Jim. And across North London to Paul. I love the fact, Paul, that Spurs will always add a little bit more drama to proceedings. Not just all this, but you managed to sack a manager ahead of a cup final as well. You'd always bring the party.
Yeah, and as you can imagine, I was absolutely delighted. I wasn't the biggest fan of Mourinho, and I've been trying to get rid of him for about the last year, so I'm glad I've been proved right. But yeah, on the European Super Rich League, they missed out the rich bit of that. It really didn't surprise me that Daniel Levy and Tottenham were involved. I think what you have to look at is there was a consortium of American owners. Three of them were American owners. And then you had Daniel Levy and Joe Lewis, who's the person who doesn't really get mentioned, doesn't really come to games, but he's the actual owner. I think Daniel Levy works for him. You know, these guys, they used to look at football clubs as, you know, who's got the biggest yacht kind of scenario in the marina. And it was almost like a plaything and a toy. But the game changed. I remember in 91, we nearly went out of business. I don't know if a lot of people remember that, just before the cup final. We were £18 million in debt, which is probably about £180 million nowadays. Yeah. We were on the verge of going out. We had to sell Gaza to stay in business, whether we won the cup final or not. The cup final we had to win to stay in business because we needed that money. And then the Premier League was formed after that, the year after, coincidentally. And that's the reason why I looked back and thought to myself, what was the desperation for Spurs to be involved in this? Are we that much in debt? Is the stadium... Because another reason why we were in debt in the first place back in the 90s was due to us building a new stand that ended up costing double the amount that it would have. And we ended up owing the bank loads of money. And I thought to myself, this seems to be a very similar pattern. And has that desperation and the loss of revenue pushed us into a corner where it was like, you know, I'm not defending this by any stretch.
I'm trying to rationalize it.
What was the reason for this? And I run a music festival, as you know, and I look at the way the festival market has gone in the last couple of years. And it seems that the festivals that spend and, you know, have the most money are losing the most money. Because they've got more to pay out and more overheads. And it seems that's the way it's happened in football as well, hence the scrambling around. I think what I couldn't get my head around was the way that they wanted it as a closed shop. And that's where they sort of showed their hand, really, and people saw through it, because straight away we knew, you know, if Daniel Levy was, Spurs were going to be in the Champions, the European Super League every year, guaranteed, that's guaranteed revenue, you know, for him. That's his dream. And what you got to remember is, although there's three American owners, Tottenham have a 10-year association with NFL, right? They've built a stadium with purpose NFL, you know, the only stadium in the world that's kind of got a purposely built NFL stadium as well, or pitch. So that relationship's there. So you can understand that with those other three American owners and the association we have with the American and American sport, these conversations must have been going on for a very long time. And I wouldn't be surprised if City and Chelsea kind of went along for the ride because, you know, they thought they might miss out on something. But it seemed quite interesting that those two seemed to be the first two to back out. Mm. And then the others had no choice. Because there was no backing there. So, it's not surprising at all. Daniel Levy's got form. Remember when we were building a new stadium, he was going to move us to Stratford. He was going to franchise us then. So, you know, it might have been an idle threat to get his way. And this kind of might have been a manoeuvre for them. But it just seems so ill-conceived, because why would you risk the wrath of the fans and football in general? Have the American owners just kind of misread the situation? Because, as I think it was Jim alluded to earlier, they're so used to moving franchises across that, and you know, even though American fans are up in arms, they're very hard-nosed, and it's just like, so what? You know, we're moving. And maybe they've misread the situation, but it seems very, very naive for people with that amount of money and that amount of business sense to make such a dumb decision.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, on to Chelsea then. And Chris, obviously, Chelsea the first to pull out. It must be tiring being the constant moral bastions of English football.
Yeah, it genuinely is. I mean, we've been doing it now since football started again in 2003. We've really been pushing that. I mean, I'd also think Chelsea deserve a modicum more criticism for providing the first advert for a European Soccer League, Super League, in the 0-0 draw with Brighton last night, which was an absolute dirge. But to come on to sort of us and the Super League, It felt like a bad fit from the off. It sort of sat with sort of my understanding of Chelsea since 2003 is a little bit. It's just chaos and trophies, and that's kind of Abramovich, similar to the City owners. He would be richer without his football club. He's put money into it. He's not seen it as a vehicle to make it. And the fact that he chased Pep for a long time. He's chased particular styles. He's chased players himself. He's put players like Shevchenko into Mourinho's plans and let that manager walk out sort of the next morning. He's looked at it as a sport, and he's used it maybe for sports washing, but he's looked at it as owning a football team which go and do things on the pitch. And latterly, his team's PR, I would say, has improved around things like anti-Semitism and sort of during the pandemic. They've doubled down on kind of changing a little bit of what the club is about. I just think, like Paul said, from Chelsea's point of view, it was a fear of not being left out. It was a fear of not being at that table of European elite clubs if they're going to have this conversation. And I think a bit of it was they were sold magic beans. I think a few of the clubs across Europe that are skint, and the Chelsea and the City who don't want to be left out, were sold magic beans. They went out for for a cow and came back with them. But I sort of think that has been reflected in their statement around it, the fact that it was like a textbook piece of like slippery. It was like a group of 7-year-olds had been caught, and one of them was like, we sort of came late and we didn't really fully understand what was happening. And now we've kind of thought about the fact that we were drawing on the wallpaper. We also think it's a bad idea. And if we don't, then how come we do? And then in terms of my relationship with the club, obviously that side of it, that's sort of like slippery. Obviously there's not much in that to cling on to. There wasn't much of an apology. It was more of an excuse. But in terms of, I don't know about everyone else on this sort of chat, but I've also felt a little bit closer to certain members of the club and the players and other players in their response. I think I'll come on to sort of, I think, how fans have obviously come together, but seeing some of the interviews on Monday night and seeing them again last night and then seeing the statements on social media, I feel like we're quite far away from our footballers at the moment, but it was a bit of a leveller. And seeing Petr Cech sort of coming out into the crowd last night was quite powerful. And some of those photos of him and him being that bridge between the club and the fans, it had to be him. It felt quite important. I think from my point of view, in terms of sort of on maybe a slightly more like emotional level, I'm a Northwest based Chelsea fan. I'm very much on my own a lot of the time, and lots of the sort of divisions that we look at between fans, I'm on the other side of them. And and a bit like a classic like emo in the noughties, most of my friends with a common interest live online, and most of them and sort of seeing that play out and seeing them down on Fulham Broadway and Fulham Road, and also then seeing the shots outside Anfield and stuff, it actually felt like we were just football fans. And we spend so long trying to make everyone be different, or, you know, we happily, when a club drops a bollock PR-wise, we love to absolutely batter them and then pretend that ours is different when we do it the next day and stuff. And, you know, you change the colours in that last night, and that could have been any football stadium in the world. And lots of people who comment on European football will often tell you the fans in England don't realise the power they've got and don't realise how much they can hold their clubs to account. And it finally feels like, you know, we're together on the pitch, we're not together, and on the pitch we're against them, but off it we're all against those same men with briefcases who sit around swanky restaurants and think this is a good idea. And it's been said on it before, but they're gonna go again, and they're gonna go again. They're gonna come back. They're gonna try and squeeze something else through. They might even get UEFA on board this time and use their Nations League format or something. And I think that this front and the fact that some of the supporters groups have been lobbying politically is amazing. But that's where sort of part of this feels less like a victory and more like a, but apart from that, how did you enjoy the theatre, Mrs. Lincoln, sort of thing. And that's where, listen, the right things happened, but the wrong thing should never have happened. And that's it.
It's really interesting, and to hear Chris talk there about, you know, the unifying nature of all this and seeing, you know, the his mates bouncing outside Stamford Bridge. And I'll be honest, this says a lot about about what the last 12 months of the world's been like, that the night out I most wish I was on of the last 12 months was outside Stamford Bridge, I tell you. Chelsea Morty with all the pints and stuff. And I was like, fair play, that looks amazing. But yeah, there's not been a lot of competition. But you know, in terms of supporters unifying, and is a good point, and I think is something to remember. And I don't think I'm giving too much away when I say that yesterday in our office, one of our lot had a conversation on the phone with one of your lot, and it was, and by that I mean United We Stand rather than just, you know, Manchester United. And it was about 40 minutes, and it was basically, well, what are we going to do? And I think more of that sort of thing is good and is needed, because as this has shown, as this call has shown, as this Zoom has shown, but also, you know, as so many of the images have shown, we are fighting a lot of the same fights.
Yeah, definitely. I do think there is some differences, but all the same, I think that, you know, especially where Manchester United and Liverpool are concerned, we've got owners that, you know, take money out of the club. Whereas, you know, if somebody's giving you a lot of money to put into your club, then that does soften a certain feeling about them. I just think that, you know, if I was a Chelsea or City fan, it's like, what are their motivations still? And it's still probably, you know, you still can't really get to a point where you can answer that with those two. But with ours, I think we're clear that we've seen exactly what they're after and exactly what the end game is. And I just don't see how anybody can support that. I really don't.
Yeah, and another point that was made earlier that I think is relevant to you as well was around the players. I think it was it was Chris who said that as well about sort of feeling a bit more of a closeness with the players. And I thought someone who I noticed came out of this with a lot of credit was Luke Shaw, and his statement again went much further than what it needed to. And I just thought, fair play, do you know what I mean? Because he's not someone who's so ingrained within a football club that like, well, what are they going to do? He's not untouchable, Luke Shaw, by any stretch of the imagination. But I thought his statement was really good. I don't know what you thought.
Yeah, definitely. And I do think that, you know, from did any of us actually think that any of these players were going to end up being banned from international football and that sort of thing? So I do think that they had a platform to speak, and I don't think it was too difficult for them to do so. I think in other circumstances, you know, if that threat wasn't there and we got into bed with UEFA with a legacy sort of, you know, allocation for European competitions, then I just think that, you know, you wouldn't hear them say a word, and that's sort of, for me, it's just as bad, and that's the sort of thing that we have to carry on fighting.
I thought Florentino Perez's comments were interesting when he tried to make the case for the European Super League, and he explained, you know, that they operate with debt. And in order to continue to keep pace, they need to, you know, they need that money more than ever. But, well, the obvious answer there is don't play your players so much. So I think the players do have a dog in this fight, yeah, in the sense that, you know, I haven't heard any player that you take up arms and say, do you know what, actually, we're paid way too much, you know, at the top end of the game. And that is a plague on everybody's house. That's not just the six of us and our teams around this table. The value of player transfers and the money that goes to agents and that goes out of, you know, the game is quite staggering. But just to pick up, Paul made a very interesting point, I thought, around, you know, he used the music festival analogy. When Florentino Perez was talking, I was a mind to remember. Do you remember when U2 gave away their album for free?
Yeah,
you know, and yeah, you know, half the world was enraged. You know, about the how could Apple dare do this? You know, now I'm a U2 fan. Do you know what I mean? So it didn't bother me in the slightest. But I remember Iggy Pop gave the John Peel lecture the same year at. At the Six Music Festival, and he basically said he really, really lamented what U2 did, and Radiohead did a similar thing where they said name your price for your album and that sort of thing. And he said it's not okay to give away your product for free just to stay massive, you know. And what Florentino Perez was basically saying, you know, is we need this European Super League just to stay massive, you know? And that's the thing that I think is really sticking in the throats of the average person, because essentially, it, you know, the money is going to be extorted out of us guys, isn't it? At the end, you know, at the end of the pyramid.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a really good point, and it is, you know, as I say, all about staying there, Emily, which kind of, you know, does stick in the craw, as Jim said, because so much of our football identity, you know, is around earning it. And look, you guys have been, you know, all the way down to the third tier and all the way back up again. So you know what it's like to be punished for being crap, but also to be rewarded for being really, really good. And you've had both. And you need that journey, don't you, to appreciate it even more?
Listen, I started off in the late 80s and City were just the butt of everybody's joke. And that's the club that I signed up for, you know, working class fans. And I've been up and I've been down at season ticket in Division 2, home and away, stayed loyal. And then when the money came, everybody was like a bit kind of like, all right, whatever. But then I was slaughtered the other day by Nicky Campbell on Five Live because he was like, well, you're saying all this and you're outraged and stuff, but you celebrated the trophies, didn't you? What am I supposed to do? Turn my back on the club for everything that I've endured across the years?
Yeah.
And we've took so much from rival fans. We take it all the time, you know, the empty hand jokes and stuff like that, but we're working class fans, we're rich owners. What are we supposed to do, seriously? And it was the idea of it being an enshrined kingdom for me.
Yeah.
Invite competition into it. Have promotion and relegation, but they want to keep it all for themselves because it was just pure selfish greed. It was just complete and utter arrogance. And the idea of football being this enshrined kingdom is what stuck so deep in my throat because, no, it's not what it's about. It's like it echoes everything that Pep said yesterday. Football is competitive. That's what people love about it. I was at Wembley when Dickov scored that goal. Oh, my God, unbelievable. I was there when Aguero scored the goal. I was there when Vincent Kompany scored the goal against Leicester. It's those moments like that. And for me, it was the moment where they said the Premier League were coming out and, you know, threatening to kick us out. And I thought, I can't stomach the thought of not having a domestic league. Because like the sign said outside Stamford Bridge last night, give me a cold and wet, rainy night at Stoke. I've been at Stoke through like inches of snow before. And it's one of the coldest grounds in the UK, you tell me that. But give me that. Give me St. James's Park. Give me Goodison. Give me Villa Park all day long. I can't afford to go to like Barcelona into the one and all that. And to be quite and perfectly honest, I don't want to because it's not what I signed up for. We've never really fallen in love with the Champions League, City fans. And I know that we've had this beef with UEFA and all that, but that's why we get the empty hand jokes, because we kind of boycott it because in a way we've not really taken that much to it. And I know that like we celebrated like crazy when we won the quarterfinal, but there was a guy like who works for Full Time Devils and he was telling me like all the time, Emily, if you win the Champions League, you'll fall in love with it and you'll understand it and you'll know what it's all about. But we've just never really taken to it. So we have always seen UEFA as the big bad guys. That's why it was so like, why are we getting into bed with them? But I liked the idea of a rival for UEFA. I don't mind that. If they would have done it, it could have been really, really exciting. Mm. But invite the competition into it. Let others have a chance because it's been exciting this season. No disrespect to you guys, but seeing like West Ham and Everton push for the top four and Leicester and... but it just infuriates me as well when people talk about takeovers and Premier League specifically. Why was it when Blackburn won the league with Jack Walker's millions and when Leicester have done it with the Far Eastern contingency, a fairy tale? But City and Chelsea have always been made out to be the big bad wolves when we win the Premier League. It's just, it's takeover money. And Their trophies wouldn't have been won without money, but it's always us to blame and it just infuriates me. But I await to see what City say at this point because it was a very concise statement. There was no apology. And I think we'll probably be hearing from Caldoun before the week is out. If we don't, then I will be I mean, I am upset anyway, but we need an explanation, and the fans and the loyalty deserve that, don't they?
Yeah, all fans deserve an explanation, absolutely. What do you think will happen next, then, Paul? And I know it's a big question, but as Jim says before, this isn't suddenly going to go away. You know, not everyone's going to go, oh, okay, that's fine, and sort of keep quiet. You know, the club still want change. The club still want more power. And where there's lots and lots of money to be made, people will always try and make it. So what do you think sort of the most likely next steps?
Well, I think they need to definitely look at the new format of the Champions League, because if... Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like they want to play 10 games before Christmas, which is, you know, I don't know how they're going to fit that in, first of all, but it could diminish the quality. There'll be, you know, there's a lot of meaningless games anyway in the group stages at the moment. And are you going to increase that to even more meaningless games? And that's not being disrespectful to smaller teams. It's just in terms of competitiveness. We want, you know, competitiveness means that everyone can compete, but it also means that there's some sort of competing on a not an even level, but, you know, we don't want it to get silly. You know, there has to be some sort of system, you know, and I'm not including us in this by any stretch of the imagination, because we're lucky to even, you know, it's a bit embarrassing being around that table in the first place, really, calling yourself a super club. But yeah, I really do think they need to look at the restructuring. I think the problem is if you do have another rival to UEFA, then we might go down the route of boxing, where you don't know who's champion, because, you know, there's, you know, someone holds the Super League title, someone holds the Champions League title. They won't play each other because they both hate each other, you know, so that could be difficult too. I think the overriding feeling for me is that the worrying thing is that these owners, you know, I touched on the fact that they've lost, you know, shitloads of money, which we probably don't even know about, and shitloads of prospective money, which we don't know about in terms of sponsorship and stuff like that. But the bottom line is they can actually cover these losses. They have got, they're billionaires. Mm. They have got the money to cover these losses, but they don't want to. They want us to cover them, or TV to cover them, or something else to cover them. Which begs the question, why are they the custodians of the club anyway? Because that shows that with the Tottenham Stadium, for instance, we were sold this dream, just like Arsenal, that if, you know, we build this stadium, we'd be able to compete with all the clubs in the world, we'll have all the, we could compete for any players. That's not actually transpired. What's actually transpired, we've got a fantastic stadium that is now open 2 hours before the kickoff, 2 hours after the kickoff. It looks like a shopping mall in there in terms of what you can buy. So really, you're increasing the revenue and using the fact that you're building a new stadium to make the club better, which is not what's actually happened. Because even though they want to cream all that money in, Tottenham, they don't want to, when it comes to spending for players, always, we've got to be prudent, you know, we can't splash out. And it's like, hang on a minute, you're not giving us prudent prices when it comes to pints of beer and food, are you? So, you know, you can't have it both ways. And you're seeing, you know, I talked about the American model, and there are some things I love about it. I watch NFL, I watch NBA, and the model's great because it started out as a franchise, and that's the way it's always been. And I love the thing that they've got salary caps, and that you never really get the same winners of those leagues, you know, unless they're brilliant teams with brilliant coaches. You know, it's a very even keel in terms. So there are some stuff to be admired about that. But we're not America. We come from a completely different psyche. We've got football comes from the working classes. It's always been that way. And I'm not trying to be a traditionalist. Of course, things have to change, and they have changed. But, you know, with everybody's agreement, not just because somebody's rich and they want to get a better for it.
100%. Huge thanks to everyone for joining us. That's been really, really interesting. I've enjoyed it. Thanks a lot to Emily, to Chris, to Jim, to Paul, and to Anthony. Hope you've enjoyed that as well. We shall see. We shall all see what happens next. But as everyone's hinted at, it doesn't feel like the story is quite dead and buried yet. Sports Social Podcast Network.